Joining us now is Dr. Khaled Abou El Fadl, who is a distinguished professor of law at the UCLA School of Law, where he teaches international human rights, Islamic jurisprudence, national security law, law, terrorism, Islam and human rights, political asylum and political crimes and legal systems. He is the author of The Great Theft, Wrestling Islam from the Extremist, and he has an article in Monday's New York Times, Perils of a People's Coup. Welcome to Background Briefing, Dr. Khaled El Fadl.
Thank you. My pleasure.
And I spoke yesterday with Jawad Nabulsi, who's one of the organizers of the original revolution, and he gave a very bleak portrait of what's happening. It appears that the counter-revolution against Morsi, which has been driven by protests where a petition of 22 million people asked Morsi to step down, and the original people who brought about the original revolution are largely a part of that group. But it appears that the Mubarak-era police, and perhaps in collusion with the army, are trying to capture the counter-revolution and basically misreading it as a rejection of democracy instead of a rejection of Morsi. Is that your understanding of what's happening?
No, yes, that's actually quite accurate quite perceptive as well. The progression of events leading up to this coup is a very important part of the story, because right after whether it's the presidential elections or the parliamentary elections and the parliament that was abrogated or the Shura Council elections, in this whole, and these are six different electoral votes, and with a net result of zero. And throughout this process, there was the reappearance of sort of the old corrupt centers of power who own television stations, they're privately owned, and newspapers. And these television stations and newspapers did nothing night and day except give Egyptian citizens the sense of insecurity and the sense of pending doom. At the same time, Saudi Arabia kept Egypt in a steady state of shortage of gas and oil, and so you had constant electricity short outs and constant suddenly queues would form at gas stations and so on, all which was miraculously lifted right after the coup, by the way. And it was clear that these forces were intent on, and many of the old Mubarak partners reemerged again, now this time as critics of, as democratically so-called committed, I doubt very much the commitment to any democratic system, but sort of playing the role of democratic critics of the government. And unfortunately, what I feared and expected, and then frankly tried to warn against, is that the numbers of protesters who had a lot of reasons to protest was immediately jumped on by the military, and a very important player here is Amn al-Dawla, or the state security apparatus. I mean, the security apparatus was extremely not just offended, but they felt degraded after the revolution, because several of their centers were stormed, their files were opened, and during the revolution they were constantly attacked, and their policies of torturing and killing people exposed and so on. And what they did is that they refused, as sort of the police on the ground, they refused to perform their job. So Morsi is the president, and yet the police is absent from the streets, absent from even regulating traffic. Crimes would occur, and the police is nowhere. And the security apparatus reappeared now in full force. That's the same apparatus that I think is actually responsible for the massacre that took place yesterday, killing 54 and injuring typical methods of repression and torture and so on have suddenly reappeared as well. So it is a great worry. I believe that it was essential that while we send a very strong message to the Morsi government saying that you are incompetent and that we want you to step down, but at the same time that there would be an equally strong message that we do not want the military involved in another coup and a complete rejection of the idea of a military takeover and promises of turning it into some... The military should not be allowed to pick which civilians they want in power. It's an egregious precedent.
Again, I'm speaking with Dr. Khaled Abu El Fadl, who is a distinguished professor of law at the UCLA School of Law. He's the author of The Great Theft, Wrestling Islam from the Extremists, and he has an article in Monday's New York Times, The Perils of a People's Coup. And in your article, you say no country did more to undermine Mr. Morsi's government and celebrate its fall than Saudi Arabia. The Saudis understand that the threat that the Egyptian democratic experiment once posed to Saudi autocracy is gone. And, of course, that is illustrated by the fact that when the coup was announced by the army general, standing right next to him are the leaders of the Saudi-funded Salafist al-Nur party. They've already rejected Mohammed al-Baradei as the prime minister. So the Saudis, they bought a coup, right?
I mean, they had played a very... The role of the saboteur, I would say, throughout this process, one very telling tool or a piece of evidence that we can look at is the Arabia Channel, which was created by Saudi Arabia as a counterbalance to Jazeera. Arabia had since the election of Morsi had done nothing but a steady stream of, alarmist coverage, much of it just simply inaccurate and so on. Of course, and they celebrated the coup and continued to do so rather without... any reservations. I mean, there's not even an attempt to sort of play along with the appearance of objectivity. But other than that, what must be understood is that many Saudi princes and influential people like Bandar bin Sultan and Amir Turki and many from the ruling family and their patrons had a great amount invested in the Mubarak regime because the Mubarak regime allowed them to purchase a great deal of real estate, prime real estate, for way below market value, basically through bribes. And so they have a deep financial interest in the perpetuation of a corrupt system in Egypt. And one of the things that they ran into after Mubarak was overthrown was the removal of the state prosecutor who, the one who was just reinstated by the Egyptian judiciary, who had a long history of looking the other way when it comes to the corruption, corrupt deals involving Saudi princes and Saudi investments. That was one of the key factors that made them determined to and they were initially they were quite vocal about supporting Mubarak and threatened before Morsi's election made threats to was it caused all types of financial damage to the Egyptian economy if Mubarak was put on trial. But ultimately, they made peace with the military, and very much the military became the guarantor for them. The military pretty much said, you know, don't worry about the democratic process. We will make sure that the state policies do not become unbearable to you. That promise started being difficult to keep under the Morsi government because of the six elections and the Morsi government, while an incompetent government, but it was not a corrupt government. They were not out to make money and get rich, and they were not. They were not playing along with the sort of Saudi interest paradigm. And so since that time, Egypt was hit with one shortage after another, very much sort of like economic sabotage. And ultimately, of course, they were the first to congratulate Sisi. And by the way, the current transition president appointed by the army is a man who worked in Saudi Arabia for over 10 years, the member of the Egyptian Supreme Court, who is now the acting president. So he has extensive ties with Saudi Arabia and sort of a history of accommodating Saudi interests. And so it is a bleak picture, and the revolution is being, I think the revolution has been stolen. The question is, will enough Egyptians wake up to realize that you cannot build a democracy by undermining the electoral process, that politics has to remain a civilian dynamic, a civilian struggle, and has to remain civic, where the army and especially Amn al-Dawla or the security forces are not prepared to lose what they believe are the gains and advantages made through this coup without a fight. And that's why, for instance, the massacre that took place is a result of that. They will kill and have arrested. There's about 100 people who have just been picked up from their homes yesterday, that in addition to another 200 that have been picked up in the past week. And I'm sure that they're being tortured and, you know, so on. So the army and the security forces will put up a fight, and there will be very bloody cost to try to undo the effects of this military coup. There are a lot of Egyptians who want to believe that this is a people's coup, that these are just the demonstrators in Tahrir were they represented the Egyptian sovereign, and that the army simply acted to give effect to the will of the people. And that now the army is simply being a good faith ambassador, and the army will put into place a process that will put the democratic train right on track, and which will continue just marching along as if nothing has happened. Of course, I mean, that view is so naive and so burdened by blinders that it's literally disastrous.
Well, I thank you so much for joining us here, Dr. Khaled Abu El Fadl. It's no surprise that during the original revolution, Obama got phone calls every day from the Saudi king screaming at him, saying, mm-hmm. "Let Mubarak kill those kids in Tahrir." Now they've got their second chance, and they bought a coup, and people don't get it. And I'm very grateful for you to pointing out the reality of this situation.
You're welcome. I wish we will speak again under better circumstances.
Definitely. Again, I've been speaking with Dr. Khaled Abu El Fadl, who's a distinguished professor of law at the UCLA School of Law, where he teaches international human rights, Islamic jurisprudence, national security law, law, terrorism, Islam and human rights, political asylum and political crimes and legal systems. He's the author of The Great Theft, Wrestling Islam from the Extremists, and has an article in Monday's New York Times, The Perils of a People's Coup. We're going to take a brief station break. We'll be back talking with the head of an organization that's petitioning the Supreme Court to overturn the FISA court's ability to allow the NSA to spy on American citizens.